Well, thank you. I want to start by thanking Maria and also the organizing team of the conference here, because I had such a great day. So thank you. It's a great honor to be here. The title of my presentation is The Women Powering of Humanitarian Aid Post 9/11 and the Work of Imagination. And this is how it starts. In November 2001, a few weeks after the US started bombing Afghanistan, Secretary of State Colin Powell proclaimed in a public address, and I quote him, "The rights of the women in Afghanistan will not be negotiable." And he added that the recovery of Afghanistan must entail a restoration of the rights of Afghan women. His speech echoed one pronounced earlier by the American First Lady of the time, Laura Bush, who, in an attempt to find moral arguments to justify the war, proclaimed also in a public address, or I think it was on the radio, and I quote her, "Because of our recent military gains in much of Afghanistan, women are no longer imprisoned in their homes. The fight against terrorism is also a fight for the rights and dignity of women." This level of attention to the plight of Afghan women was in sharp contrast to the silence that has marked the years of civil war after the withdrawal of the Red Army in 1989, reminding us of the opportunistic alliance imperial powers are able to forge with feminism. Meanwhile, Western media flooded TV channels and magazine front pages with images of Afghan women covered from head to toes under their blue burqas, a garment that became the ultimate symbol of their oppression. Sorry, I'm going too fast. The non-negotiability of women's rights was presented as a means to restore justice after years of oppression under the Taliban, an oppression primarily explained in essentializing religious and cultural terms. And as Laila Abulugot so aptly argued in a bioclassic article published in American Anthropologist in 2002, and because she writes so well, I'm just going to quote her. The question is why knowing about the culture of the region, and particularly its religious beliefs and treatment of women, was more urgent than exploring the history of the development of repressive regimes in the region and the US role in this history. Such cultural framing prevented a serious exploration of the roots and nature of human suffering in this part of the world. Instead of political and historical explanations, experts were being asked to give religio-cultural ones. Instead of questions that might lead to the exploration of global interconnections, we were offered ones that work to artificially divide the world into separate spheres, recreating an imaginative geography of West versus East, us versus Muslims, cultures in which first ladies give speeches versus others where women shuffle around silently in burqas. Mobilizing a classic trope of colonial feminism according to which white men have the duty to save brown women from brown men. The figure of the Afghan woman that emerged out of these discourses was one of a model subject of humanitarian aid, a victim in need of rescue, innocent, silent, and powerless. The root causes of women's suffering remained overdetermined by gender instead of located within a situation of structural violence derived from 40 years of armed conflict triggered by Cold War and post-Cold War geopolitical dynamics and marked by the disappearance of infrastructures, political turmoil, and struggles for survival. But portrayals of ahistorical victimized Afghan women did not only serve to attract popular support for the intervention. The narrative aesthetics of news reports also had the ritual power to constitute Western spectators as publics, as collectivities with a will to act. The spectacle of women's distant suffering was to activate moral sentiments grounded in what Luc Boltanski identified as a politics of pity, validating women's deservingness and the need to take swift military action on their behalf. So this presentation is primarily concerned with the imaginary and immaterial practices via which humanitarianism in Afghanistan has come to define women's needs and has devised programs to answer them. The argument I make is that Orientalist imaginaries of Muslim women in need of rescue permeated the humanitarian enterprise in Afghanistan. Such imaginaries, in spite of their phantasmagorical nature, have actualized specific humanitarian responses based on liberal notions of self-empowerment. The main objective was less to concretely improve the situation of women than to bolster the idea of reconstruction for Western audiences via carnivalesque performances of radical reversals. And I'm going to, you know, come back to this term of the carnival. I also maintain that technologies of the self on which programs aimed at increasing women's resilience are poisonous gifts which overlook the various forms of structural inequalities that are responsible for triggering crisis in the first place, and which hide the broader dynamics of abandonment that have marked the history of the West's engagement with Afghanistan since the 1990s. So let me start with the importance of imagination in humanitarianism. As the Finnish anthropologist Liza Malki beautifully illustrates in her book, The Need to Help, humanitarianism is an object of imagination, and humanitarian projects involve many imaginative practices. The way needs are imagined powerfully influences how humanitarianism, as a world-making enterprise, designs its action. And Malki writes, often there are ways of making such needs be, and then of making them not be. The technologies of humanitarian advertising can similarly make things be and not be. Some disasters fade away quickly for some donor publics through long ongoing, while others' newer problems are made be. So Foucault also insists that the imaginary is not false nor illusory. The imaginary is not a mode of unreality, but indeed a mode of actuality. The imagination should therefore not be conceived in opposition to humanitarian reason, but rather be understood as a productive and generative practice with real-world effects. Indeed, in the case of Afghanistan, imaginary formulations of women's needs prompted the establishment of a heavy military humanitarian apparatus whose legitimacy primarily relied on the promise to bring justice to Afghan women. The singling out of women as targets of humanitarian aid derived from analyses that conceptualized women as victims and ultimately men and culture as perpetrators. Such a formulation created circumstances where Afghan men found themselves controlled by foreign agents who considered them to be inherently misogynistic and anachronistic, and where Afghan women's liberation was associated with their capacity to resist culture and tradition. However, in this presentation, I want to insist on the symbolic and immaterial nature of the humanitarian response to imagined women's needs, keeping in mind a reflection from an Afghan friend and colleague I met when I first came to Afghanistan in 2004, firstly, as a humanitarian worker myself. And this is what my colleague told me. At least when the Russians occupied our country, they built factories, roads, and bridges. No, what are the Americans bringing to us? Mostly laws, reports, and trainings. So with gender issues high on the humanitarian agenda, a plethora of international and local NGOs started to mushroom in Kabul and other Afghan cities, competing in generosity to offer women the humanitarian gift of self-empowerment. Such a goal was to be achieved primarily through legal reforms, as well as workshops, documentation production, conferences, meetings, trainings, and other self-help methodologies, which were part of the standard toolkit of good governance designed by the international community. Experts in gender were placed in ministries tasked with raising awareness on gender issues among state functionaries and the political elite. Inspired by corporate management culture and influenced by neoliberal thought, the message was based on the view that the main actor of social change is the individual, an individual detached from external constraints and whose will is essential to bring about progress, like, for instance, on this image, you know, the will to work on the self and to develop one's interpersonal skills, for instance. So, for example, during my doctoral fieldwork in Afghanistan in 2007, the recently established ministries of women's affairs regularly held self-empowerment trainings, some of which involved elements of relaxation and mindfulness. I have described one of those elsewhere, so I spare you the details of these surreal encounters. The point I want to make here is that far from being technical and therefore neutral instrument of good governance, such workshops were part of a civilizational project with deep symbolic and cultural implications. The subtext was that Afghanistan had to catch up with modernity and that its state's representatives had to break away from ignorance and tradition by publicly embracing women's rights and gender equality. Enshrined in standard bureaucratic state-building practices, workshops and training are therefore colonial technologies of power mobilized to govern subjects and diffuse in societies narratives of progress, rationality, and freedom. Disconnected from the social reality and material needs of ordinary people, it is not surprising that the liberal conception of freedom and progress, which they sought to transmit, quickly became sources of intense anxiety within Afghan society. The director of the Department of Provincial Relations at the Ministry of Women's Affairs, in place at the time of my research, told me once in an outburst of anger, "We don't want pens, we don't want workshops, we want money to run real projects." The second point I'd like to make is the following. Because of the deep symbolic and political implications of such programs, the humanitarian gift of self-empowerment was poisonous for the women who were supposed to benefit from it. So in post-9/11 Afghanistan, a myriad of actors, such as NGOs, UN agencies, the World Bank, private companies and local militias and narco-traffickers, have come to assume a large part of the traditional Weberian functions of the state, to the extent that the state mostly materializes itself through the use of violence, symbolic or real. Dispossessed of its sovereign functions, the state can only maintain a semblance of sovereignty through the control of the moral order. As scholars of nationalism have well demonstrated, women occupy a central symbolic function in the reproduction of this moral economy. So in a society torn by violence and war, women's bodies have become the field through which statehood enacts its sovereign power. Discourses of freedom and liberation reiterated by international actors have had the effect of reinforcing a sense of urgency in maintaining communal boundaries along stereotypical gender lines, with a nation imagined as an idealized, desexualized maternal figure in need of protection. In the process of rendering the state legible, and as a result of the deep entanglement of women's rights with nationalist discourses, the political elite has tended to reinforce patriarchal versions of culture in an effort to thwart its local critique and assert its independence. Calls by members of the Afghan parliament to reestablish the moral police, for instance, should not be interpreted as mere signs of a patriarchal conservative culture, but rather be placed in the context of an occupation where external injunctions of women's empowerment bear significant colonial traces. Indeed, as observed in other colonial encounters, the control and disciplining of women is a symbolic means of asserting domination. So caught between abstract humanitarian discourses of empowerment on the one hand and nationalist ones defending orthodox versions of culture and religion on the other, Afghan women's capacity to remain in control of their own lives has been extremely constrained and limited. Such tensions have created existential doubts among them about the kind of performance the most apt to express their continued allegiance to their communities, to their family, to their religion. Because women fear the social sanction reserved for those who are considered as traitors, they cannot make choices that do not show some level of adherence to the patriarchal norms promoted by nationalism. This does not mean, however, that women are bound to passivity. Rather, their agency has to be placed in the poisonous environment created by this humanitarian occupation. In other words, caught in the dynamics of identity politics, women's public appearances need to have local cultural resonances in order to be recognized as legitimate. So sketched against this backdrop of images of burqa-clad women that invaded Western media reports on Afghanistan, images of the new Afghan woman have been informed by liberal conceptions of femininity, visible, autonomous, self-driven, emancipated from religion and tradition. Such heroic figures regularly appeared in Western news with media outlets eager to feature stories that would resonate with the imaginations of their consumers in the West. We were told, for instance, about the first female Olympic boxing team, the first female mountaineer, the first female orchestra conductor, the first female Air Force pilot, the first female judge nominated to the Supreme Court, Or, and even we were told about the first woman to win the Afghan version of American Pop Idol, as if women had never occupied an equally meaningful position in society at other times under different kind of circumstances. So meanwhile, stories of heroic Afghan women crafted for Western sensitivities bolstered an impression of absolute reversal. Finally, we were told Afghanistan had moved away from authoritarian and democratic, theocratic regime to a modern one based on democracy and the rule of law. While the Taliban had ruled the country through religious edicts, now the new government was ruling through laws and through a representative body. Most importantly, women were given equal rights to men and were encouraged to participate in public life and were no longer forced to hide under their burqas. The utopias of abundance and freedom that the reconstruction agenda had promised and that had come to fruition in humanitarian communication campaigns was based on a vision of radical reversals with women as the main embodiment of this dramatic change. So I qualify humanitarianism in post-Taliban Afghanistan as carnivalesque because, in my view, the metaphor of the carnival describes quite well the state of liminality in which Afghan women are currently caught. Indeed, the post-war carnival of reversals tends to hide the violence that most women continue to endure. The downfall of the Taliban regime has opened some room, of course, for some women to take part in politics, a development that could at first sight be perceived as a radical reversal of the old order. Yet these reforms have been carried out while former Mujahideen and warlords responsible for major crimes and human rights violations have been brought back to power with the support of this same international community. Besides deepening a sense of uncertainty, these contradictions are a source of intense social tensions between conflicting visions of the future of the country. So I would like to conclude this presentation with an attempt at articulating an answer to the central question of this panel. How do gendered humanitarian politics and practices exclude people from or end negotiation about how to do good? The non-negotiable nature of women's rights in Afghanistan, as I hope I made it clear by now, has primarily taken the form of self-help projects. These programs are promoting a vision of the individual that is functional to the corporate market economy. The woman who is meant to emerge at the end of the carnival is a woman free to choose, resilient, in control of her life and detached from communitarian and family responsibilities. The characteristics of this ideal woman, imagined outside of the specific social, material, and political reality that shapes Afghan women's lives reflect the turning of the humanitarian gaze away from those in need and the reframing of helping others in terms of narcissistic self-work, a dynamic that Ofra Kaufman, Shani Orgad, and Rosalind Gill have coined selfie humanitarianism. The ideal woman targeted by humanitarianism in Afghanistan is at once a victim of oppressive patriarchal culture and a courageous, resilient agent refusing to be silent. Self-empowerment is meant to unleash her inner potential. The neoliberal logic that guides this discourse is grounded in the view that it is internal processes rather than external objective conditions which are to blame for a current predicament, hence obscuring global inequalities, injustice, and exploitation, and reinforcing neoliberal psychological imperative to work on the self. Such programs have to be placed within a longer history of imperial engagement with Afghanistan from the 1920s onward, during which the country has been conceived as ungovernable, successively labeled as the Kingdom of Insolence by Michael Berry, for instance, the graveyard of empire, and the land of the unconquerable. Journalists and political pundits have regularly referred to Afghanistan as ungovernable, using an increasingly familiar litany of tropes: authoritarianism, sectarianism, tribalism, terrorism. The ungovernability that is supposed to characterize Afghanistan is used to explain the condition of spiraling violence and failures to establish order in the country. It is my contention that the trope of ungovernability is not a mere representational form aimed to produce an essentially unruly and primitive other whose condition of redemption is civilizational self-help. Rather, I posit self-empowerment and other self-help programs and instruments geared towards the perpetuation of a mode of governance based on perpetual disorderliness. As Omar Dewashi argues for the case of Iraq, ungovernability is to be conceptualized, and I quote him, as a feature of the internal dynamics of power enmeshed in its disordered operation, a framing particularly apt at capturing condition of governance within zones of exception and abandonment. This last point is particularly well illustrated by the fact that 18 years after the intervention of the coalition forces, the issue of women's rights has become negotiable again. The initiation of peace talks between the US and the insurgents revealed the underlying opportunism and cynicism that has marked the humanitarian intervention in Afghanistan from the very beginning. In a too well-known scenario where women are used as pawns in imperialist power games, women's condition is now presented as a reflection of Afghanistan's inherent disarray, a discord that functioned to justify the permanent state of exception under which Afghanistan has been maintained since the end of the Cold War. Thank you.